It's hard to believe I've been in the spoiler room for 3 years, yet here we are. As I look at my crew, I begin to think about what to do for our third special series of episodes. Then I look at the calendar and realize it's the third week of the month. And I look down at my drink and realize it's the third drink I've had today. After a moment, it hits me like a fist of John Wick. Everyone talks about the first film, but what about the third film in a franchise? So, pull up a chair, grab your favorite drink, and listen in to our third special series of episodes I like to call Third Time's a Charm. And welcome. Yes, this is where we're kicking off our special series. I don't know if I'm going to do one every year, but we're in our third year here, coming up on our third anniversary for the spoiler room. And I was thinking, I wonder if what we should do. And then the idea hit me. It was all threes. And so no one really bothers, it seems like, to talk about the third film in a franchise. But that's exactly what we're going to do with these series of episodes I like to call Third Time a Charm, where we're going to look at the third film in a film franchise of various genres. And tonight, to help kick off this special series, we have a great crew sitting in the room with us tonight. First off, the BFD himself, Glenn Bittner. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
What was that?
I said I'm fine. How are you? Dirtbag.
There it is. There's the dirtbag. I was waiting for it. And next to Glenn, he's back with us once more. It is Scotty D in the His House. Hello, Scott.
Hey.
He sounds so enthused to be here tonight to talk about tonight's movie.
I have a piercing pain in the back of my skull right now.
Well, we're glad that you could join us.
Well, you know, it's fine. You guys are here, so you can keep it company. So
we can keep it company. And back after his long, long run on stage, it is the actor, the man, my good friend Doctavius Stephen is here with us tonight. Hello, Steve.
Huh? What? Oh, hi.
Are you awake?
Doing this? Oh, yeah. Oh.
Are you awake?
Oh, yeah, totally.
I'm sorry. Did you want me to write out some lines for you?
No, I was just confused by such a long and involving intro for me. So I was confused. I didn't realize. So thank you. Hello.
You're welcome.
It's good to see you again, Steve.
Yay! Yes.
Always great to have a returning voice, and especially being Doctavius, and especially for tonight's films, which is, yes, keeping with the third time's a charm, we're looking at Police Academy 3, Back in Training from 1986.
Academy 3. Got it. The state says it can no longer afford two police academies.
We better call
Mahoney.
Your favorite graduates are back.
We're here.
Mahoney.
We're rubies.
What? Hooks.
Don't move. They're back.
Callahan. Hightower. Tackleberry.
Do you want to kill me?
Backler. And Jones. Their assignment?
We're going to make one hell of a cop.
Thanks, Dad. And would you give this to Mom for me?
Mold a brand new generation of recruits into a fighting machine in a matter of weeks.
Shit!
Then, together, they're going to save their beloved academy the only way they know how. By chance.
Quick!
Police Academy 3, back in training.
You're sitting in a non-smoking area.
Put it out when I'm finished.
You'll put it out now, mister.
What they don't know can't stop them.
Directed by Jerry Paris, and we have the alumni of Commandant Lassard's Police Academy return to the school that trained them to help train new recruits and prevent its closure. And that is about... That is the plot. It's not really deep here, folks. Police Academy 3, it did gross about $43 million. It does have a good chunk of returning cast. And let's get, I just want to get initial impressions tonight. You know, here's the third in the franchise. So they've done a lot of jokes in the first one and the second one. Doc, how did you feel about Police Academy 3?
Well, when I was younger, when I first got a VCR, I had three general levels of movies. There was the movie I wanted to get on a nice quality pre-recorded tape. There were the things that I was going to try and tape off of cable that I would tape. I didn't want to spend as much money on or time. And then there were things I wasn't going to bother with to tape because they were on all the time. That was the Police Academy movies. Because they were on our UHF channels all the time in the late 80s, early 90s. There was no point in recording them because I could just watch them when they came on. And that's what I did at that time. So this was actually the first time I'd watched Police Academy 3 in any kind of quality release, I suppose. So that was interesting.
Good interesting was, or a bad interesting?
It was not as different as I expected. I'll say that for sure.
So the improved visual quality didn't necessarily improve the film at all.
I thought I was missing more of the film. Apparently I was not.
And Glenn, how about you? Your initial thoughts when you see Police Academy 3? There it is.
Yes.
I remember liking the original Police Academy a lot. And then I saw the second one. I'm like, well, that was a turn downward, but okay. And there's this one. I remember seeing this one the first time, and I'm like, wow, this isn't like the apple falling far from the tree. This is the apple falling, being kicked off a cliff into a boat that then sails around the world to a rocket that's blasted to the moon. The moon explodes and falls into the sun.
At what point is it on a jet ski?
God.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Was
this one just? I mean, it's a bunch of rehashes of old jokes. Let me introduce you to the man who taught me how to fight. I mean, it's just okay. Jones can make noises and does his little thing. Oh, why are we throwing an Asian stereotype? Mm-hmm. That'd be great. We can have that, and then. Just look at that, someone else with what's-her-face having to be all aggressive when it comes to sex because the other person just like, hey, she's got big boobs, and that makes me attracted to her. No other reason.
Yes, Leslie Easterbrook's Lieutenant Callahan, who was sans in part two. She was not there, but she was came back in part three.
She was kind of replaced by Colleen Camp in part two, at least by not character, but basically the type of character she embodied, the character that Tackleberry went for.
Which is funny, because I forgot she was in two, actually, Colleen Camp.
And yeah.
All it did was make me want to watch Clue. So, Scotty D., your sweet, sweet pipes are joined us. what did you, I kind of know where you're going with this. I believe you've got a sigh like Glenn. How'd you feel with Police Academy 3?
I can't do the sigh of justice like Glenn does it, and I can't do it to the degree that the movie deserves. No, it's a movie. It exists. It's on 35mm. It was in color. Okay, if we're going to go back, like Glenn did, yeah, I'd seen the originals and everything. I remember hating this movie. I was really looking forward to it back in the day because I had seen the first Police Academy, you know, from like a tape that I wasn't supposed to be watching that my brother taped off of late night HBO or something. And then I saw Police Academy 2 when that hit out, and I really wanted to see part 3 because, yeah. And I'll tell you why, is because now. Police Academy when I was a kid was hilarious. Watching it again, as I did, I watched the first three again to get refamiliarize myself with the show. Police Academy, it's all right. It's not great. It's not terrible, but it's not great. It's got some decent parts in it, but it's kind of R-rated. Just like barely, like they throw in boobs basically to make it R-rated. Otherwise, it's not really that risque. Police Academy 2 comes out. I don't know what it is about this movie. People really slam it. We reviewed it a while ago. My friends Austin, Jesse, and I on a show called Film Geek Central presents the films of 1985. They hated it. I still think Police Academy 2 is funny as shit. That movie, I don't know what it is. That movie cracks me up every time. I don't know what it is about that one entry in the series, but it's hilarious. And it was PG-13 in the early days of PG-13, you know, where you could get away with a lot more. And it was kind of looked at something like, okay, this is not for kids, but it's not quite bad enough for R. So adolescents, early teens, they're fine. Police Academy 3 is for kids. Yeah. It's they went this from this entry on, they went straight PG, and they really sanitized it. Just like I think Steve and Glenn actually both said, a lot of the jokes that worked in the previous films, they said, okay, let's just repeat that joke. And so there's lots of callbacks and stuff like that, and there are parts of this movie. I mean, there's bad parts of this movie. I did not hate it as much as I did back in the day. I'll tell you that much. But it took me a while to get used to it. Basically, thank God for Tim Kazurinsky and Bobcat. Yeah, those are the two people who saved this freaking movie, in my opinion.
Save is maybe a strong word.
Save might be a strong word. Yeah.
I'm just kind of a reformed guy, you know. No,
did you step on a Lego?
Yeah, I know. What the hell was that?
I have no idea. My horrible Bobcat Goldthwait impression. But, yeah, revisiting these. I haven't revisited these in years, and that's kind of why I always love doing these types of series, and especially doing the third one. It makes me watch the first two, and I found them. The first one is all right. It's amusing. I found these, but I didn't find these nearly as funny as I was when I was a kid when I first watched them. Especially the first two. The first two I enjoyed a lot more than this one. Yeah, and it is 80s PG, so we do get a topless scene in here. So just throwing that out there in case anyone's curious. There is a topless scene at the beach. For no apparent reason, because 80s comedies, you know, you had to show some nudity, regardless of the rating, I think.
God, I don't even remember that.
In this one or in the second one?
Or was that the second one?
That was the second one. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. That was the second one. That's, you're right.
I suspect I would have remembered something.
You're
like
right.
That.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they all blend together. They all blend together after a while.
See, I only watched the third one, so... In an effort to have this other perspective. So
yes, that's right, because he does the balloon joke in two with the tailor getting his new equipment. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Sure.
It kind of blends all together.
PG-13, you could do that. You could have like a quick nudes, a quick shot. It didn't even matter what you were showing. I think Woman in Red, I think, is a full frontal shot, and that was PG-13.
And Nuns on the Run had a whole shower sequence.
Yeah. Yeah. It was basically right up until like right after summer of 1989 is when PG-13 kind of stopped being PG-13.
So in this film, though, so we're going to dig into this a little bit. But see, it shows you what kind of film this is. I was thinking of two because, as Scott said, two was actually.
Oh, Mark was thinking of two, all right.
I was, four actually in that scene. But
oh, my.
But in this one, It was really weird. What threw me off when I first watched this is it opens up. We get Mauser, who played by Art Matrano, who makes you really miss Police Academy 1, who played the main bad guy, if you will, in Police Academy 1.
G.W. Ailey.
Yes. Yeah, it MASH. Makes you really miss him because
agreed.
Mauser felt like. Glenn, does Mauser, Commandant Mauser, feel like a Walmart version of Bailey?
Yeah.
I mean, what did you think of them putting him in play? it just felt like they want to get him, but they couldn't get him, so they got someone to look like him at least, right? But what'd you think of Commandant Mauser's character?
It's copycat. It's what they're trying to do. They're trying to copycat. It's all this movie is trying to copycat lots of stuff. I didn't like it. I especially didn't like freaking what's his face, his assistant,
Proctor.
Oh my god! Just no. I mean, there's this comic relief that's annoying, but it's like, I don't know, why do you need bad comic relief in a fucking comedy?
That's not a bad point.
His timing was so different from everyone else around him. I don't know if it was awesome or awful.
He felt like the kid who was given the script, who's trying to act like with the big boys, but just not quite getting there.
Kid who walks in the middle of a movie is out of his element?
Okay. Yeah, kind of like that. At least that's the way I felt with him. But Scott, what did you think about Mauser and Proctor?
Well, Mauser and Proctor were the villains in part two. Mm-hmm. And they were the villains in part two because they couldn't get G.W. Bailey. Because Hugh Wilson, who had done the first movie and had like some other credits like Americanathon, Tunnel Vision, he had created WKRP.
Yes.
Which is an awesome show.
Yes.
He went on to do Rustler's Rhapsody, which is a spoof of singing cowboy movies. And if you ever get a chance to see it, it was one of the biggest surprises because that movie was hilarious. Absolutely hilarious movie, Rustler's Rhapsody. And G.W. Bailey had a huge part in that where he played like the town drunk, who was like also the sidekick. And so they couldn't get him for part two, so they had Mauser, Art Matrano, for part two, and they kind of brought him into part three along with two of the bad guys from part one. So they're trying to like bring everybody in together.
Oh.
Yeah.
That was the whole purpose of the opening scene is you get the two villains from the first one, side villains from the first one connecting with the villains from two for three, because three needed to combine one and two, apparently. Yeah.
Well, that's what makes three, so that makes sense.
Oh my god, yes. Steve, don't you dare make me think that they are trying to work on multiple levels here.
No. I don't even think they had all level, but let's continue.
So Arbitrato was kind of the second tier choice. He's all right, but he was designed to be the replacement for Bailey in the second to third one.
Yeah,
he's all right though. He's not great, but he's not bad because I have such a fondness for part two. I can't knock him too much. So, although he does not have the great ad libbing skills of G.W. Bailey, who, if you look, I mean, even in the bad films he's in, like say, like I don't know, Police Academy 4-7. that G.W. Bailey always has really good ad-libbing skills and can bring a little extra comedic oomph to a scene, and Art doesn't quite have it.
No, he doesn't. And that opening scene, that they really try to come across, and I mean, because it opens up just like all the other police academies with a view of the cityscape. And we get a little text of the setup of the film, which is probably the most plot you'll get out of any of these movies. But then we get them meeting up in the secret car lot. And yeah, the jokes, you're right. I think you really hit it that it was meant for kids, because even in that opening, like 10 minutes, Doc, wouldn't you say that the comedy in there, you realize, oh, we got a lot more physical comedy going on here.
What parking lot has a closing time?
Because it
didn't look like it was anything but a parking lot, not like it was attached to a mall or a store or anything like that. But for all I know, maybe parking lots close in Canada. I mean, in this city in America.
With the building that says Toronto Security Bank, I think.
Really? I didn't even notice. Oh,
it's very, very much Toronto, yes.
Yeah. Not even notice that. That's awesome.
Like later on, they tried to establish it somewhere in California, I guess. Just looking at the wiki, but no. But yeah, there's a lot of physical just random gags, which made me feel it was almost as if someone had tried to explain the concept of slapstick comedy to someone who had never seen it. And like, here, I'll tell you about this Buster Keaton film I saw. And all they got from it was people falling down is funny.
Yeah.
And then like just started breaking things and getting knocked around. And it's stuff that, like we were saying, it's probably funny if you're a kid because you don't understand how things work. So if something happens, you accept it. When the car wasn't in gear and starts rolling back towards the other car and at the end of that parking lot sequence, I'm like, why would that happen? They left the car. You put it in park. Mm-hmm. And in park, it's not going to randomly slip out of park unless you have a really crap car. So I was confused. And yeah. Then it stopped being funny because I was confused. Not that it really started being funny, but, you know.
Well, what's also kind of confusing about this is the whole idea of two police academies, because you would have thought that would have been addressed in the first one.
No.
And it's not. And not only that, but Mauser is the commandant of one. But you're like, wait, wasn't he just...
He was like the second in command to the precinct captain in the second one.
Yeah.
Is this like a airport movies where all of a sudden like George Kennedy just has a different freaking job every single time you see him? First he's a mechanic. Nope, now he's the vice president. Now he's flying the Concorde.
this almost felt like, you know, I mean, they're trying to combine the two together, but I think that's step one where they kind of fail is trying to bring any continuity to this timeline by combining the two. Am I wrong on this, Doc? Is that
I'm of two minds, because we've already discussed a little bit already how this seemed to be them kind of resetting the movies for a younger audience. So similarly to some other movies I've heard you guys talk about recently where midway through a series, you kind of have a soft reboot. You could argue maybe that's what this was going to be, but there are so many references to things in the first two movies, even just watching, not having watched the other two again, going into this going, all right, they're making a reference. I can tell they're making a reference. I'll just go with it. So it's like, even if you're watching like new, it's not like brand new and fresh at that point that you could restart, I guess. It feels like they wanted everything. They wanted to like start over, but not completely start over at the same time.
Would you say that, Glenn? Do you have think that they were trying to do all this because they were trying to do maybe the soft reboot and bring in the younger audience with this, or trying to take it in a different direction?
I don't think they knew what they were doing.
Also very likely.
I think that it's just the... It was just laziness. It was lazy writing and lazy direction is what I think it was.
Not giving a damn.
Yeah.
And what's kind of sad for me with it is I like these characters. I mean, sure. You know, some of these characters are really interesting. It's just one of those where you wish they weren't taking them over the same jokes. I mean, George Gaines, bless his heart. I mean, I could talk to Commandant Lessard for many hours just because I love his performance in here. And he was consistent throughout with this. Scott, how'd you feel about at least Commandant Lessard? I mean, here he is third time in this role, and he just seems to really be the only consistently goodly written character, maybe?
No, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, not that I'm knocking George Gaines or that I don't think... I think there were probably a couple other characters that were decent, but him, I think that even this character was stronger in parts one and two because they had to make him into this thing. The great part, he does have some good moments, though. Parts that, I mean, you had to remind your... I had to constantly remind myself that even though Leslie Nielsen had done Airplane way back in 1980 and Police Squad and stuff... he wasn't really known as the comedy guy until Naked Gun, which was a few years after this movie came out. so that I, when I was watching him, I would have to say, like, no, he's just doing his own thing. He's not, it's not like a Leslie Nielsen thing, but you could see like some of the bits where he swats the fly by slapping the woman out of the seat. You know, yeah. that sounded, looked, seemed like something that he would do. Some of the best bits to the George Gaines character in this one was how people would react to what he was doing.
Right.
They have a bit where he accidentally drops a fishbowl outside of his window. And it's like a full minute later, you think it's going to like result in this thing and da 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 da. And you've almost forgotten about it. And a full minute later, Steve Guttenberg just catches it.
Yeah.
My favorite, one of the best sight gags, I think, of the thing is when he's addressing the cadets and George Gaines just walking along and the cadets just start marching sideways to go along with him. That was a funny bit. Just, you know, it might not have been an original bit. It was obviously riffed off, but it was a funny bit. You know, so that was basically how he was. I think that he was good, but he was utilized better mm-hmm. in the earlier films.
Well, you just have so many characters in this, and watching all three back to back, it was, I forgot how many names went through this series of actors and comedians. I'm like, holy crap. You know, like in the second one, I forgot that Howard Hessman was in two. I'm like,
oh, he's so good in that.
Nice. He was so good in that, you know. And here, I don't know if maybe it's just because these characters didn't gel, you know, because I think the core characters, though, you could do more with them, couldn't you, Glenn? Don't you feel like they could do more with them than they're better than the script that they're given? Some of them,
possibly. Yeah, you could. I mean, a lot can be blamed on the script here. The script is pretty freaking bad.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the performers seem to be doing their best. I mean, I like Bubba Smith, especially in the first one. You know, and even the second one, Steve Guttenberg, he's the smirky dick in this. Yes. But that's his shtick, you know. And yeah, Bobcat and Sweet Chuck really do help carry some of these scenes along because there's just so many characters, and they seem to be the ones that they thought out the most, or at least get the best jokes. I don't know. You were going to say something, Scott?
There was a random sequence where they're exercising and Sweet Chuck's shoe flies off and lands and goes right into Zed's mouth.
Yeah.
That, I think, was the moment I laughed. I think was the only moment I laughed while watching this. But when I'm sitting by myself, I don't tend to laugh out loud a lot. That one actually caught me off guard enough where I'm like, yeah, all right. Most of the other jokes like that, though, are just kind of these random things that, and even this one, it's a random thing that happens. There's no reason for it to happen, but it does. And I think they were expecting, well, we just have random things happen and it'll be funny. You're like, you know, well, Lessard's dumb, he'll drop his goldfish out the window, we'll just make sure it doesn't end in a dead goldfish. There's no real reason for anything. There's no build to a lot of it. It's just, you know, stuff.
It's the writing. You know, the first script was done. I mean, the first script is no classic, but it was done by Pat Proft and Neil Israel.
Yeah.
They're good writers. The second one was written by a couple of Saturday Night Live alums that would later go on to do a lot of Eddie Murphy's films and stuff. Those are good writers. This one, the writer, the writer Gene Quintano did a lot of movies, and he's done action films, he's done comedy films. Focusing just on the comedy films, though, we're talking King Solomon's Mines.
Hey,
it was positioned as one that certainly has about as much jokes as this one. Loaded, we're talking Loaded Weapon 1.
Hey,
we're talking Operation Dumbo Drop.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no hay on that one, is there?
No. Mark knows my history with Loaded Weapon 1. It's all good.
It's a downturn. And, you know, the guy actually, you know, I'm not picking on the guy. He wrote a couple action films I like. He wrote Sudden Death, which was a hilarious Jean-Claude Van Damme film. If this guy wanted to be funny, you went to one of his action movies.
Well, yeah, I mean... You look at the King Solomon's Mines, which check out the spoiler room. We did do an episode on that. I forced my spoiler room crew to watch those films for me to talk about them. I thoroughly enjoy those films, but because those are more action parody films, and I thought there was a little more thought put into them. This one, whenever I watch a movie like this, Police Academy 3, it harkens back to, I think, maybe Bruce Willis. I think Bruce Willis said it when they were talking to him about Die Hard 2 or one of the action stars. They said, back in the 80s, no one really expected to do sequels. I mean, now it's almost, you know, a given that you get actors signing up for. So they didn't know how to handle sequels very well. You know, very few franchises did it back then. You especially some of your comedies were usually one and done. So Not everybody in Hollywood was comfortable or knew how they wanted to approach it, especially producers. And this one, it definitely feels that way. It feels like, oh, we've got this hit. We got to keep going. And, you know, well, what are we going to do with these guys? Well, I got this funny bit. Okay, let's work that in there. Let's do this funny bit. Yeah. Okay, now what are we, half hour into the film? Okay, let's bring it around to the original plot of the schools competing. Okay, we're done. Skit, skit, skit. This was like trying to be like Second City, like a TV show almost in a way, you know, or short skits. It never got the full feeling of any type of major story or even the competition. Glenn, did you ever really get that feeling these schools were actually competing for anything?
No, not at all.
I mean, they didn't set that up at all. I mean, what'd you think too of the differences in the schools, if you will? I mean, Mausers was pretty much what, Nazis?
They're fascists, at least. But, I mean, you're wearing brown shirts.
It's a typical thing, and you know, it's the hey, it's the goofy ones who are actually the ones who are doing it right, not the ones who are organized or prepared, and you know, because they're the fascists, and as you said, they're like the Nazis because they're all, you know, rules and crisp uniforms, and they're the bad guys. You can always tell the bad guys because they look good. Like, okay, fine, I guess, but no.
And you do get some of those wonderful, not, you know, pre-80s, pre-90s jokes in here, especially with a character named Nagata, who is as you can tell, folks, the Nagata character, if you look at 80s comedies, racial stereotypes were always considered for some reason funny,
particularly Asian.
It's particularly Asians, and this poor character, and don't get me wrong, I like the actor, but the way the character is handled and written, in fact, all the Asian characters in here. Scott, we had ADR for almost every single Asian character. What the hell's up with that?
Oh, it was, well, I mean, it was the cheapest stereotype they could get away with. You could get away with just about anything back then. If you wanted to, you know, cast a gay character, make them flaming. If you wanted to, you know, say like, okay, you're Latino, so you're going to be a street thug. You know, you could do that in the 80s because people will often wax nostalgic about it. But no, it's because people didn't know any better. Or if they did, they were just too insensitive enough to get their heads out of their asses. So no, we got the awful, you know, Asian stereotype, and it's not new to the series. There's a bit in part two where a Asian grocer can be heard to say broccoli, you know, and stuff like that. In this one, well, let's look at the character of Nagata. He's Japanese, they say, right? Okay. He also knows kung fu.
Mm-hmm.
He sleeps on a bed of nails. Right. He does the meditative technique of holding his hand to the flame. You know, it's basically like he's miscellaneous Asian.
You know? Very much so, yeah. Even when Mauser's insulting him, he goes back and forth between, you know, and which makes sense because he's the bad guy. He's not supposed to know or care. But he goes back and forth between what would be considered a Chinese or a Japanese insult within a line. And I'm like, wow, that's impressive.
It's kind of like,
it's good, but impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the writers didn't care. So why should the audience? You know,
It was tapping into a certain amount of, there was always, in the 80s, there was that concern that, like, especially the Japanese were going to buy up the United States. They were buying, you know, Sony was buying up, you know, MGM or whatever like that. So there was that vein of, that they could tap into, well, we got to make sure we can, you know, still put them on our level and blah. Whatever. Well,
that's what makes this thing so dated is the jokes. I mean, and it's kind of sad because Brian Tochi plays Nagata, and he was the voice of Leonardo in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 and 3. He very talented individual. And if you look, he was even in Revenge of the Nerds.
That's what I thought.
Fur Pie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That same guy.
Basically playing the same character. It's the same character.
Can't Hollywood hire more than one Asian at a time? I mean, it still has this problem.
Well, no, now they just say, oh, we got a white person. Isn't that the same?
Yeah, right.
Oh my God!
Yeah, they're running into that now with the whole Ghost in the Shell movie. Yeah. But yeah, Brian Tochi is actually a very talented individual. So to see him play a character like this is back then even. Well, not only do you have because you're right, the scare back then were Asian businesses buying up American businesses and land and taking over America. That was the one thing, especially in the mid-80s. But let's not forget the yuppies, who we get made fun of as well in this series and in this one, especially considering we have basically a male version of Kim Cattrall's character, only this one's not hit on by Steve Guttenberg, which I think would have actually made for an interesting plot point. But we do get the rich guy in here, and the rich are looked down upon, aren't they, Glenn?
Well, of course they should be.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the 80s, that whole yuppie stereotype.
That was, well, I mean, that's you have the same thing. That's, I mean, in Meatballs, you had that with, you know, you had Camp Mohawk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the rich ones are always, because they're not the underdogs. The underdogs are always the ones that you want to root for. So that's mm-hmm. the ones that they always set up. It's the underdogs. And,
yeah,
you know, the rich people are not underdogs.
No, they aren't. But at the same time, it makes you wonder why they are hanging with the underdogs then as well. His motivation. I mean, Kim Cattrall's character in the first one at least had a little bit more motivation. But this guy, we don't even get his motivation, do we, Scott?
Oh, I was every time he'd pop on screen, I'd be like, who the hell are you? So, I mean, there's like almost nothing to his character except, and I, you know, you can correct me if it's not the same person, because honestly, we saw the character so fleetingly that I might be mixing him up with somebody else. But in an early scene, there's an early scene that's a joke that does not make sense. It's where he hands his bags to Bubba Smith.
Yes. Yes.
Thinking that he is the porter. Oh, porter, cash my bags, would you? And of course, Bubba Smith, you know, rightfully tosses his bags overhand because, you know, screw you, racist. But, and which would have been a funny bit, except why in the world would anybody think he's a porter? Not saying, not even taking the racial stereotype. He is 7 feet tall and dressed in full police dress uniform, as everybody is else around you. Why would you ever think that? It's a joke that on paper should have said, wait, that makes no sense, and they filmed it anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, Glenn was right. I mean, this whole thing, the police academy in itself started with, like, I think a lot of this probably went back to like the 70s. There were two movies that came out. One was aimed at kids, one was aimed at adults. The kids one was Bad News Bears, and the adult one was Animal House. And it was showing the mismatched group of misfits who were always looked down upon and was always thinking of losers, but woo, we're the party people and we're going to get those, take care of those squares, and we're going to show that we can do it better than they can anyway. And that was a formula that was repeated, as Glenn mentioned, in Meatballs and everything else. And I think Revenge of the Nerds, and I think Police Academy was kind of the cop show version of that. And that's what they're trying to replicate here. But here's the problem is that it's now by this point was like, say, like maybe 6 years after those movies, and it was a cliche. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there was Police Academy 3. There was also about 20 other films probably released that very month with the same plot. You know, hey, they're in law school. Hey, they're in the fire department. Uh-oh, paramedics. Oh, don't call 911. You know, and, you know, they'll have stuff like that. And so it wasn't novel anymore. And so, and by this point, they didn't even care with the writing to make a joke that made sense on paper, you know? So,
right. Yeah. The '80s comedy, the early '80s comedy were the underdog comedies. You're absolutely right. That was your basic formula for the downright comedies. I'm not talking quite like, Beverly Hills Cop or whatnot, or your Lethal, what were your action comedies? And those, you know, we're talking that are films that are meant to be straight up comedies. That it was always the underdog, especially you mentioned Revenge of the Nerds, you know, pretty much anything, Porky's, you know, the underdog, the perv guys, they end up, the guy ends up being the hero at the end, the misfits do. They end up, you know, being better than the guys who you would expect to win. But you're right, by this point in 86, that had been beaten so dead. I mean, the horse was, it wasn't even a horse anymore. It was like a chihuahua. Yeah,
well, it was
in some movie producer's bed is what it was.
Yes. Yes, it was. But there are fleeting glimpses. I mean, we're sitting here and there are bits and moments of this film that I did find entertaining. The jokes that I wish there were more of, and it felt just a hint like the original, was the scene with the taxi cab driver and Nagata when they pull up. In that Steve Guttenberg's character comes up and he's talking to the taxi cab driver who's trying to rip off Nagata by saying he owes him $700. And Mahoney, played by Steve Guttenberg, calls Bubba Smith's character over.
Hightower
says, "Hey, Hightower, this guy just said something about your mother." I enjoyed that part at least, because I'm like, you know, here you have Hightower coming over and you want to see him, and you know he's not going to, but it was just one of those little bit of jokes that I kind of actually enjoyed. And then he rips the meter out because you got the taxi cab driver saying the meter doesn't lie, and Hightower shakes the meter and throws it back and he goes, "Oh, no, that's a lying meter." That little bit there I actually kind of enjoyed. It didn't feel quite so blatant. Or am I off, Scott?
No, it's fine. It was a fine joke. I mean, that's not a bad scene. I would say, you know, as I kind of briefly started to mention before, like, you know, the first like 15 minutes or so, 15, 20 minutes of this movie, that's rough. That's so rough. Basically, as soon as they get back in training, they should name the movie that. Anyway, as soon as they got back in training, you got to meet some of the cadets. Now, do we give a shit about the cadets? No. There's two cadets we care about. But it set it up for some better material, because obviously the writer, Gene Quintano, didn't have the drive or creativity to use the old crew and just bring them on other assignments in the field. He says, "Now let's just throw them back in the academy." And so you had some better bits there. You know, that was not a bad bit. I still say that you were briefly mentioned this before, and I didn't touch on it then, so I'm sorry. But
No, go ahead.
But I think that Bob Goldthwait in this movie, who becomes a good guy because he was so popular as the bad guy in the last one, and Tim Kazurinsky, who is also in the second one, those two, pairing those two up, you know, the street guy who used to menace the, you know, European timid shop owner, you know, and have them both in the, that was a really good dynamic, seeing like how they kind of had like this love-hate relationship that developed throughout the film, because their comedy timing was good. I mean, Bob Goldthwait was a really taking stand-up by storm at that point. And Tim Kazurinsky was a Saturday Night Live alum, and they had really good comic timing, really good physical humor. And you could tell that they could really riff on a scene, and they could make something work. If it wasn't working on the page, they would try to make it work better. And that's when things really worked. I really think that those are the only two people that I think did a damn thing in the movie.
Would you agree, Doc, that probably Sweet Chuck and Zed, you probably could watch the movie with just those two, couldn't you?
Pretty much. I mean, just briefly going back to the taxi scene you mentioned,
yeah,
that one works because there's a little build to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually goes somewhere. It's not just a random joke and then it happens. It builds up to that point. Sweet Chuck and Zed work together so well that they become the dynamic. I mean, not to go on, but I remember there being a cartoon series and them being like pretty much the main two characters in that. My memory of it is very faint, but that's the only thing I remember from the cartoon. And to be fair, even a bad Bobcat Goldthwait impersonation, as we've proved tonight, is still memorable as Bobcat.
Sorry.
No, we've all done it. We were all doing it. But everybody knows what you're trying to, you know, it's either that or, you know, Gilbert Godfrey, or you're trying to pass a kidney stone, one of the two. So it's the dynamic between this mousy guy who's been stepped on and this anarchist that has a lust for life, who's he's almost squirrel in a lot of ways. He's just kind of, hey, what's going on over here? You know? So yeah, but when they build an affection with each other, it is very interesting because, as you noted, they're both very good actors. They're both very good comedians and they went somewhere with this. A lot of the other characters that get introduced as the new crew, they're barely on screen. They're part of the reason some of the stereotyping on Nagata didn't bother me is he's barely there.
Yeah.
Just every time he's there, it's pretty much some sort of stereotype. But other than that, the rich guy, I don't even remember if he had a name.
He
was rich guy.
Kirkland, I think. Maybe.
Sure. I believe you. Cause I don't remember. Cause that's how important he was. Sure. That's how much of an impression he made. And then there was the girl that was there. So Mahoney had someone to mac on. That's about it.
Yeah. Cause because you had to have that. And Glenn, how about you? Would you say out of all these characters, Sweet Chuck and Zed were probably the ones you were more interested in?
Well, because there was nothing else with anyone else. I mean,
yeah.
I always forget her name, the African-American woman. I mean, she's one joke. Yeah.
The Yeller?
One joke repeated over and over again.
Yeah, that's Marion Ramsey. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That's all she is. Mahoney is... I never liked his character in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You're the cocky smartass and everyone's supposed to love you. Whatever. You're the type of person I've always despised. And yeah, there's no one else to really even care at all about. I mean, why should I care about any of these people?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And what's interesting about this is they would go on to do one more with this particular pairing group, which would be a Police Academy 4, Citizen on Patrol. And then, yes, they've made 8 of these, I believe.
7.
I thought seven. It was 7.
7. It feels like 8.
There were 7, a live-action TV show, and a cartoon. I'd never seen the TV shows, so.
Yeah, and then Tackleberry died.
Yeah.
Did he die?
The actor that played him, he died at 51 from a heart attack. Same as his father, same as his grandfather.
Oh, that's right.
All 3 of them died at 51 years old.
Oh, that's too bad.
I do remember that, yeah.
Wow. This series would go on, and they'd end up replacing Mahoney with another guy who was Dime Store Mahoney.
Well, they do it all the time. I don't know. I don't think that. Ooh, I don't think that. I don't think that Bobcat was in anything beyond Part 4. I could be wrong about that. I remember that as soon as he signed up for 3, he was already making jokes about how much he hated these movies.
Yeah.
But he did. But he says, I did it because I was a struggling stand-up comic. I got one good role, and they're offering me money so I can put my kids through college. That's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And yeah. So they did that, and then there was, you know, Steve Guttenberg didn't like it, but then they'd say, okay, Steve Guttenberg's not liking it either. We got to get a new Steve Guttenberg. They had to get basically a new everything. So unless they wanted to do like a full like reboot, like they did with the Scrubs TV show, you know, they're not going to do it. They're not going to have this happen.
Yeah, Matt McCoy, I feel bad calling him that, but it felt like the way the character was written, it was Dime Store Mahoney.
It was.
Ted McGinty wasn't available.
Nick played by Matt McCoy, was basically, you could tell they just put a different actor in, but it was still written for Mahoney. They just changed the name, but the character was pretty much the same, which the rest of this series really goes on to be the same. They never really... And I feel bad because I like a lot of the actors in this series. But, you know, you look at it and I guess they made enough money to keep going. But, you know, they dwindled. But they really drove this franchise into the ground. And Police Academy 3 back in training, I think, was the first real signs of that fading of the series. And it should have probably stopped at 2. Wouldn't you say, Glenn, that this is kind of the beginning of the end for the Police Academy franchise?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, so much so.
Yeah, I mean, just you can tell the idea is kind of let's do the same jokes. And it's the writer, you're right. I mean, we see that now, though, with the parody films, the comedy films, to where they no longer have like an overarching actual story to them. They just have a series of skits, you know, and pop culture references. And this one ends like a lot of it. The ending of this film is such a different tone from the rest of the movie. Doc, what you think about the ending, the whole boat chase and everything? That must have been where most of their budget went, but that's a rather long boat chase. And didn't it just feel completely different from the rest of the film in many ways?
Well, for a movie that barely had a scene that went on for more than a minute or two, to have this sequence, this prolonged sequence that goes on for the last act. Yeah, it was long because all of a sudden it was like they were pretending they had a story and a structure. They didn't really, you know, just it comes out of nowhere, really. It's a means to end it. But had this could have been what they could have actually, you know, it's these threads. You feel that there are these couple of threads in there that they actually had an idea and just either couldn't crank it out in time or didn't have enough time to develop or whatever, or just didn't care. Probably didn't care. They were making money. To some degree, that's all it takes. But yeah, it to have this prolonged sequence go on for that length of time. And you knew just the way that what little a story was going. There was going to be some redeeming something that the police academy, our heroes would do to win the day, and that's what happens. But beyond that, yeah, it is just kind of odd to have the hero action sequence, even though you knew it was coming.
But also, isn't that like also what they did at least for a few movies after this? I haven't seen beyond this movie since I was a kid.
Same.
And but if I remember, didn't part 4 end with some sort of balloon chase?
Yes.
And part 5 had some, like, I want to call them airships. I don't know if that's what they are, the ones that they throw, that they drive through the Florida Everglades.
Oh, yeah.
They had a chase on those, I remember. I can't remember anything beyond that. But like they had these like weird chase things because it's like they figured out they couldn't figure out how to end it. So they were ending it like cop shows. Like, okay, we have to do a cop show. Pretend it's a cop show. Pretend it's sweeps month. Okay, so we can't just give them a car chase. What are we going to give them? Jet skis.
Oh, yep. Yeah. You know what people love? People love that movie, Gator. We need something like Gator.
Oh, my God. God. Oh, I'm going to tell my friend you said that because he's a Burt Reynolds fan. He's going to love that.
I heard you were ripping off my Gator movie.
Glenn, what were your thoughts on it? Would you say that this ending is just like a 90-degree turn? And some of these stunts,
Watching this makes me remember it now thinking this is probably why I hated the Hobbit movies so much, because the freaking let's have a 78-minute long chase scene reminded me of the speedboat.
The Hobbit movie was ruined because of Police Academy 3.
Well, no, it's because obviously Peter Jackson loved the Police Academy movies too much.
Yeah. That's true. And
I'll never let you go, Mahoney.
Well, it will wrap it up here. And no, we haven't even mentioned Michael Winslow because he was the sound effects guy. That was his entire role of the movie.
Yep.
Of the franchise was to be there to make sound effects. And don't get me wrong, talented individual did some great sound effects in the day, but they really made his character a one note character.
He made me laugh in the first two.
Because they found
something interesting to do with his sound effects. This one, they just kind of repeated it. Like part one, there was a bit where he's playing video games, except he's not playing video games in his dormitory. He's pretending to play video games. They did that here. They did the great bit where he did mimic the martial arts movies. In part two, they repeated that here. You know, they didn't give him anything new to do with it. It was just like, just make some noise. You know, you know that scene like the last movie? That's what you're going to do. So don't even bother to remember lines.
Well, I mean, even down to not with his character, but in general, the shtick, as we mentioned, the rich guy in the limo, we get only this time it's Feckler's the one on the hood of the car instead of his wife like the first one. But we basically get rich person in their limo with someone driving by who's on the hood of their car, just like in the first one. This rehashes so much from the first two films. If you watch them all back to back like I did, I mean, before they were kind of spanned out over a year or so, so you might not have noticed as much, but watching them like I did, marathoning them, it was like, holy crap, did they just like copy and paste from the first two scripts into this one because they got laughs. It was like someone watched the first two films and watched the audience's reaction and go, let's do that again, only put them all in one movie. But we got to come up with a story. All right, let's do this. Okay, now, more laughs. And, you know, I mean, even down to only this time it was instead of Mauser's hair getting glued to his hands, getting glued to his hair, it was the tape on the eyebrows.
Yeah.
But it was still the same joke. And even down to Glenn, the blue oyster shtick.
Oh, yeah. Let's just have that back. Why not?
That's a running gag.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean it's necessarily a good running gag. It's just a running gag.
Yes.
Oh,
well, you know those gay men. They just will jump on anyone who's naked.
Well, they don't jump on them. They applaud. But yeah. they're all dressed like Rob Halford.
Yes.
Which I thought was very, you know, farsighted, actually.
Yeah.
It's that kind of bar. It's the leather bar.
Well, yeah,
it's not the lace bar. It's the leather bar.
It wasn't just a gay bar. It was a leather gay bar that, yeah, they looked like tryouts for the GIMP for, you know, Pulp Fiction.
You know what? If cruising took place at the Blue Oyster Bar, it would be a lot more better remembered today.
So, yes, in this, I'm going to do a little new thing here with this. And we're going to end each one of these episodes where I'm going to ask each of our crew members, and I'm springing on this now because it's a surprise, because I just came up with it. It's huge. Everybody's going to love it. It's going to be
great. Don't even start, man. If you if you don't want to trigger me, man, if you don't want to trigger me, you better stop that right now. I'm not kidding, man. I will fly to Wisconsin just to punch you in the face.
But then I'll get to meet you in person.
It's not all bad.
Tonight, with this special series of Third Time's a Charm, I'm going to ask each one of our crew members hear their final thought and if they think in the franchise, if for the film is a third time a charm in this franchise. So we'll start with Doc. Doc, what's your final thought with Police Academy 3 and is Third Time a Charm?
Okay. Police Academy 3 is definitely a movie that happened, as we've noted. It's very fast paced through most of it, but it allows you to not really have to think about a whole lot. And I suppose if you start laughing right away, just the random speed quality of that would probably keep you laughing through most of it. As I noted, after watching this, on Sunday, I felt the need to watch a comedy after this because this was a documentary, clearly. And I watched the Marx Brothers Duck Soup, which is also a very fast-paced movie in a lot of ways. But it's funny to me, whereas this one is not so much. And that's not to really, I know we've been kicking this thing in the side walls a lot tonight. It's not awful in a lot of ways. It's just not good. Not good. You know, it's got the police person's ball, so it works to be a little PC, and then you've got Nagata, so it's very all over the place. It tries to be a lot of things. It doesn't really achieve anything. So is the third time the charm? No. No, it's not. Not at all. Hell no.
I know where this is all going, but Scott, how about you? Your final thought, and is third time a charm?
Let me tell you what I remember most about this movie from when I was younger. I remember opening up an issue, I think it was like a Sunday issue of, it might have been the Philadelphia Inquirer, which was like their newspaper in there. And I always looked at the movie ads. I always loved newspaper movie ads. And there are always blurbs at the top of the movies telling you how great the movie is. There was always this thing to tell you how great the movie is. And you could always tell like how good the movie was. And from a young age, you can tell, okay, where's the blurb from? Does it have any blurbs? If there's no blurbs there, it's probably going to get great reviews. They had a blurb at the top of it, which surprised me. Because even at that young age, I knew people hated the Police Academy movies. The blurb to get people to see the movie said, and this is a pretty accurate quote, I think, "The Police Academy guys are back to bring you their brand of low humor." That was the blurb. The blurb was not a positive blurb on their own newspaper ad. It was just a slightly insulting description of the movie. No, Third Time is not the charm. You know, if you can find a supercut on YouTube or something of Tim Kazurinsky and Bobcat in this movie, that's good. Otherwise, there's a few good bits, but a lot of them just go nowhere. A lot of it was regurgitated from earlier films, and they were really trying to clean it up for the kids. However, I will say it's probably the most family-friendly film Georgina Spelvin's ever been in. So, yeah.
This is very true. Ed, Glenn, how about you, sir?
Burn it. Burn it all. Just no. No, I'm done. That's it. This is not a third time. The third time is harm.
That happened a lot quicker than I probably expected.
That did. I didn't see it coming, but now
that's probably a much better film too, Glenn.
Third time's the harm.
Sounds like a Dirty Harry film.
It sounds like the third album that a hair metal band in the 80s would put out. Hey girl, third time's the harm. Woo!
And that's their title.
I'll catch it, baby.
That's their title track too. That's their title track too, is Third Time's the Harm.
Third Time
is the home. Rockin', rollin', partying, boobs.
See, but there wasn't any in this film because it was trying to be family friendly.
It was trying to be family. So you don't even have that.
It was just a tight white t-shirt at one point. That was probably the closest you had.
You don't even have that quality of 80s comedy because that, you know, back in especially early 80s, if it was a comedy, a straight up comedy, at one point someone was going to be without clothing, normally female. No reason. It just happens.
They're funnier that way. That's why.
Well, clothing wasn't made as well as it is now.
Oh, that too. Yeah, that's true.
It just tended to fall off.
Especially if you were in a film stuck in the genre of comedy. So hopefully you enjoyed this special episode. If you did, please leave us feedback. Email us at spoilerroom.smp@gmail.com. The email is in the description here, or go over to specialmarkproductions.com where you can contact us and see the archive here. And now we're going to go down real quick where you can find some of these fantastic crew members when they're not here. Glenn, go.
You can find me on YouTube with the B-Movie Bunker. You can find me on Facebook with the B-Movie Bunker and Guy in the Bunker Productions. My website, guyinthebunker.com, or just follow me on Twitter at Guy in the Bunker.
Awesome. Scotty D.
You can catch me at moviocrity.com, where I have started updating regularly again. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I know you were waiting for it. And you can also catch my web series, Moviocrity, at vimeo.com/channels/moviocrity.
Where they allow boobs more so than YouTube. So
yes, I mean, you can see the things on YouTube, but they're a bunch of killjoys. You don't want to have to log in and everything. So
yeah, that's log in. Yes, I'm 18. Click OK. And Doc, how about you, sir? Can they find you anywhere?
Oh, December in the picture of Dorian Gray went well. Next time I'm scheduled to do anything right now is March 6th through 8th. Shakespeare Raw begins again at Best Place. We're starting off with a play that people remember, Romeo and Juliet. And I've already asked who's going to be playing narrator Lemmy. And I haven't gotten an answer yet.
And that's in Milwaukee?
Milwaukee, yes. The Best Place downtown Milwaukee.
Awesome. Fantastic. And thank you so much for listening in on our special series. Check out the next Third Time's a Charm episode. If nothing else, it'll be these episodes. I'm going to try to time them out to be the third week of every month because I thought it was kind of cute. I don't know. But
math.
Third Time's a Charm. Third week of every month. Listen to this special series. And you'll never know what you hear in the spoiler room. But it's definitely going to be fresh, though we do spoil the movies. Say good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.